I use it for skateboarding. Don't worry, I washed it. Sorry, but I have to know what the story is before I continue the job. The carpenter stood in the doorway and watched while the woman swabbed the bottom of my foot with a clear liquid that smelled like ginger. My face got hot, and I held my finger up to him to wait a second, though I didn't know what I was going to say next. The woman pressed a cotton ball to each puncture in my foot, and she started to wrap it tight with the ace bandage. Every turn or so, she would glance up at my face to see how I was. Her son left the bathroom, and I heard a TV go on in what used to be the room Nicky practiced his bass in. I looked up at the carpenter and said quietly, "I'll talk to her husband." "Fine. Sorry about your foot." I watched him walk down my hallway with his tool belt and shorts and no shirt. I felt abandoned. The woman pulled the last bit of tape around my ankle, kept it there with her thumb, then held it down with a safety pin. She smiled at me and we both looked at each other a second, which made me pull my leg up from her lap and stand up. But I couldn't put weight on my foot without a burning ache shooting up my shin. She helped me out of the bathroom and I half leaned on her all the way to the living room, where she guided me to the sofa behind the silver coffee table. I was about to say no, but she moved a pillow, slid the bowl of sweets off to the side of the table, then rested the folded towel there for my foot. All I could do was sink into the softness of the couch. "I carry you tea and sugar. You must for rest." I watched her walk into my kitchen and reach into a cabinet for a clear glass cup. On the wall across from me were paintings of mountains on a waterfront, of bearded men in robes on horses. On the lamp table beside me was a family portrait of the woman smiling next to a bald man in a military uniform. Sitting in front of them was the same boy who'd answered the door, only he was younger, his face more smooth and round, and beside him was a beautiful young woman with long black hair that went past her shoulders and hung over her white blouse. She had her mother's eyes and the gentle smile, too. "That is, of course, our family pictures." The woman rested a black breakfast tray on my lap. The tea steamed up into my face as I sipped it, and she went into the kitchen and came back with a small bowl of red grapes. "Thank you," I said. She smiled at the other end of the couch and put a cube of sugar in her mouth before she sipped her tea, placing the cup and a saucer on her lap. She was looking at my bare legs, the high hem of my cotton shorts, her face taking them in like my mother would. My cheeks flushed. I could hear the muffled noise of the carpenters cutting through wood above us, then hammering something, then cutting some more. The woman was sucking softly on the sugar in her mouth. The grapes were cold and sweet, but I wished I'd never driven up here last night, and I put the tray on the table, sat up, and stood on my good foot.
"No, you must for rest your foot. Your friend must to the hospital bring you."
I made my way around the table and hopped to the door. Draped over the edge of the silver table was the folded white towel, my blood drying all over it. "Thanks for your help, but he's not my friend. I don't even know his name." Connie Walsh was in a meeting when I limped up the stairs above the Cafe Amaro and told Gary I wanted to see her and I'm not leaving till I do. He looked down at my bandaged foot and asked what happened, but I sat without answering because I felt like killing somebody right then. Anybody, but not him. Especially when he dragged a chair over for me to rest my foot up on while I waited. Connie Walsh's morning clients were two women a little older than me and better dressed. They walked out of the conference room laughing, but when they saw me sitting there with my foot up on a chair that almost blocked their way, their laughter dropped down to smiles as they squeezed by and disappeared down the stairs. My lawyer stood in the doorway. "What happened to you?" "They're tearing my fucking house apart." "What?" I hopped by her into the meeting room that smelled like clove cigarettes. All the tall windows were open, and the room was full of sunlight. I leaned against the table and crossed my arms over my chest to keep my hands from shaking. "They're remodeling it. What are you going to do about that?" "Have a seat, Kathy." I don't want to sit down. I want to fucking kill somebody. How come they don't even know they're squatting in somebody else's home? I'm tired of this shit. I lit a cigarette. Connie sat down and called out to Gary to please bring us 2 cups of coffee. She looked up at me with a patient look on her face. The courier just brought over the paperwork from the county this morning. I was planning to review it and call you this afternoon. I don't want you to call me. I want you to call those Arabs who are cutting up my house. My voice broke, but I wasn't going to let whatever was under it break through. Gary came in and left the coffee. My foot felt swollen, so I pulled out a chair, sat down, and rested my leg on another. What happened? My yard is a construction site. You were there, Kathy? That's right. I emptied a whole pack of Sweet and Low into my coffee, stirring it while Connie launched into a soft-voiced lecture on why it's a good idea to stay off the property so she can do her work unencumbered. It's very important we're both clear on this, she said. Agreed? I looked at her, at the premature gray in her hair, at the serious look in her face, and I was still so mad at how far all this was actually going my throat felt closed up, but I said yes, then drank from my coffee. Connie excused herself to go get the paperwork. Outside, on the flat roof of the Roxy Theater across the street, 2 pigeons were perched on a brick chimney stack in the sunlight. They stood together looking out over the street below, their beaks jerking front and back, right and left, as they took in the scene. My foot hurt. I smoked another cigarette and thought how at least today was my off day with the cleaning, and if I was lucky, I might be able to put enough weight down tomorrow to work. But on the drive over, my right sole ached so much I had to sit almost kitty-corner and use my left foot on the gas and brake pedals, making me sit as low in the seat as an old lady. I started to stand to go find my lawyer, but then she walked back into the room smiling, carrying a manila folder in front of her. I was right. They sent your signed statement with everything else. Here. I took it from her. It was the original statement both Nikki and I signed in front of the notary. I looked at his signature, each letter of his name written so neatly, while mine was a hurried scribble. I used to think he did that so people wouldn't have to decipher it, so he wouldn't make things hard for anyone, so he wouldn't leave behind a mess. I used to think that. Connie Walsh said a few things, and I looked up and nodded at her, like I'd heard. And it's obvious they decided to put it to rest with that statement, so I'll fax them a letter today and we'll follow it up with a phone call before offices close. If they don't offer to rescind the sale immediately, we'll sue the county for a bundle. Are you still at the motel? I shook my head no. I want you to call those people in my house, too. They're already more at home than I ever was. That's not right. My lawyer tapped her pencil in the palm of her hand. Did you get their names? I don't know, Baruni or Bamini, something like that. They're Middle Eastern. Please call them up and tell them to put the roof back together and get out. She left the room and I heard her tell Gary to draft a letter for the courier service. The pigeons flew off, and I told myself I should feel good the county had sent the sworn statement that would get me back into my and Frankie's house. But there were 4 holes of heat in my foot. A stiffness in my neck from sleeping in the car, a tightness in my throat, and for a second I saw myself emptying most of the storage shed into the Bonneville and driving straight back east, just pull into my mother's driveway and tell her everything, that I had no friends, I was smoking again, I just scraped by cleaning up after other people, all I do is watch movies, I don't remember, my husband left me and I lost the house, Ma, it's gone. Where are you staying, Kathy? Connie walked in reading some paperwork. She had on her round glasses. Nowhere. You're not with friends? She was giving me eyes that were sincere but holding back too, and I pegged her right away for the kind of person who couldn't live with herself for not doing the right thing, but also the kind who could never say no, so they really wanted you to lie to them so they wouldn't have to do the right thing, like invite me to stay a week with her. Yeah, I'm with a friend. You are? They always did that, too. Pushed your lie till it almost broke. I want to be back in my house by this weekend, Connie, all right? I can't promise you anything, but we'll do our best. She smiled and stood and showed me to the door. As I hopped to the stairs, she said not to worry, and she hoped my ankle would feel better soon. It's almost easier being down and alone than when you're up and there's no one to share the view with you. Not that I was feeling that great as I drove south on Skyline Boulevard through Daly City in the sunshine. Addicts are supposed to be famous for expecting disaster around every corner from good luck, but now I did have my hopes up a little Connie Walsh might have this mess straightened out by the weekend. I needed some distraction. I rested my right foot on the hump in the middle of the floor beneath the console. The ache wasn't as sharp, but now there was a warm throbbing that came with my heartbeats, which were faster than normal because I was smoking practically one cigarette after another. I was also thinking of Lester Burden again, his sad eyes and crooked mustache, his little station wagon driving off into the fog. I knew I'd been thinking of him off and on since then. I kept seeing that dark need in his face as he sat across from me at Carl's Jr. Men who have that look usually want to bite into you like you're a fresh, cool plum, and after they've bitten, sucked, and chewed, they expect your juices to come back and stay sweet. But Lester's need seemed different than that. There was a gentleness there, too, a patience. So maybe it wasn't really a need at all, but a wanting. Maybe he wanted. In Daly City, I pulled into a gas station and hopped to the restroom with my makeup bag and toothbrush, a clean t-shirt, and pair of underwear. I cleaned myself up, climbed back into my Bonneville with my wrapped foot, then dug through my pocketbook for Lester Burden's card. It had slipped into my checkbook between two blank checks. Lester was something called a field training officer, and his office was at the San Mateo County Sheriff's Department in Redwood City. I put the car in gear, used my left foot for the gas, and drove onto the Bayshore Freeway heading south.
The sun is warm upon my arms as I push the bright red lawn cutter that started with one pull of its rope, and I smell benzene and that American scent of green grass that is cut in the heat. The engine is loud, but still I hear the work of the Najars upon the bungalow. The afternoon remains in their first workday, but already they have completed building the frame of the widow's walk into the roof, and I push the cutter from one end of the property to the next, and I see them lay new boards of lumber across the structure and drive nails with their steel hammers in the sun. The tall grass falls away beneath my machine like dead soldiers, and I am grateful for the silly blue hat upon my head, for it keeps the skin there in the shade, and even my forehead and eyes are protected. But I am grateful for so much more than this. After a lunch of chicken, tadik, and radishes, I gave to a smile permission to ride his skateboard down to the BART train to go visit his friends until early evening. The young Najars had left in their truck to purchase building materials, and I sat at the kitchen counter reviewing the real estate pages of the newspaper when my Nadi paused in her cleaning and kissed me on my cheek. She stood close to me, holding the folded sofre to her breasts. "Why did you not stay with me last night, Masood?" My wife has 50 years, but she spoke as would a young girl, a new bride. I thought perhaps she was disappointed in me, but then I regarded her smile, the fashion in which she held her chin low, looking up at me with those gavi eyes, and as she took my hand and led me back down the corridor to her room, my heart was a flat stone moving over water, and my breath was held like the boy counting the skips of his good fortune. Afterward, as the Najars resumed their work above us, Nadi put the blue kola upon my head and laughed as I stepped out into the midday sun. I laughed as well, for except for an occasional television show she barely understands, Nadi has not laughed. Not in the Pooldat apartments, she has not. But here is different. Here she seems to be living as if she is no longer waiting for life. Here she is free of our own masquerade, our own lies. I continue to cut down the tall grass with ease, making straight and orderly lines of the dead green, and I make the decision, yes, we must stay here for the summer season. It will be good for us, a good rest. I will continue to work daily for securing a buyer, but I will enter into the contract that the property will not be available until autumn. This will also give me the necessary time for finding new properties to purchase, for it is clear I must buy only bungalows such as this, homes that are auctioned by county or bank. Perhaps I will discover a pleasant home or apartment we can rent while I continue to buy and sell for a profit. These have been my thoughts, and they have been most pleasing thoughts, for I feel once again like a man with his hands on the reins of his own beast. The Najjar tells me the platform overlooking Corona and the sea will be ready in 2 more days' time. Saraya and her new husband in their honeymoon trip on Friday, and so we must invite them and the groom's family to our home for a small celebration. I will instruct Nadi to prepare her best chelo kebab, both bar and the tender meat of the kubide. I will purchase champagne and arrange chairs on the widow's walk, and we will all toast the health of the bride and groom. To our own health, salamati. At the street, I extinguish the engine, leaving the rows of cut grass for Ismail to rake into a bag upon his return. I wipe the sweat from my face. I am unable to cut the grass at the side of the house due to the Najjar's ladders, tools, and the new lumber they have stacked neatly upon the ground beside the small section of old roof. As I push the cutter past all of this, a Najjar calls down to me. I raise my face to the two young men, but the sky is bright, and even with the new kola upon my head, I must further shade my eyes with my hand. "Yes, sirs, you are doing a superior job." "Thank you," replies the one with the tattoo of a restaurant upon his shoulder. "Did you get everything settled with that woman?" "Excuse me? To what woman are you referring?" "The lady who cut her foot. She didn't talk to you?" "If you please, come down here so my neck does not freeze this way." The Najjar descends the ladder with his leather apron of tools hanging over his short pants. He is not wearing a shirt, and I see his back is almost the color of a Bombay Indian. When he reaches the ground, he turns to me and wipes the sweat from his forehead. "I just wanted to make sure she talked to you. She said she would." "Oh, yes, my wife told me your girlfriend cut her foot. I am sorry to hear this." "Girlfriend? I never saw her before. She came up to the roof this morning all upset because we were doing this job. She said she's the owner." My hands become heavy and my voice trembles. "What are you talking, young man? I am the owner of this home. I have paid for it cash. Who is this woman?"
"She looked nutty to me," the other Najjar says from the roof, smoking a cigarette. "She's swimming with one fin. She's probably down the street telling somebody she owns their house, too."
The Najjar beside me laughs and I smile, but I do not quite believe in this smile, and stop. "In my country, crazy people are put in hospitals, but here you let them wander as free as sheep." "This is true," the young Najjar says, picking up from the ground a paper bag of nails, then climbing back up the ladder to his work. The other one extinguishes his cigarette beneath his foot upon the new boards. "Please tell to me if the woman returns. Thank you very much." I continue pushing my grass cutter to the rear lawn that is completely in the shadow of the house. There is only a thin line of sun upon the ground at the base of the tall hedge trees, and it is there I stop to pull the cutter's rope 2 times before the engine starts. I give it as much benzene as it can drink, and I feel thankful for all the noise it makes.
For almost 30 minutes, I sat in the car parked across the street from the Hall of Justice building in Redwood City. It was 8 or 9 stories high, and the concrete sidewalk was so white under the sun I had to lower the visor and put on Nick's old Ray-Bans that were too big for my face. Across the street from the Hall of Justice was an old courthouse building with a huge dome of stained glass, and there were no trees on either side of the main street, just parking meters and shining cars. Every few minutes, I got the urge to open the door to go find Lester for a possible lunch date, but then I'd think of that ring on his finger, that sadness in his eyes, and I'd smoke a cigarette, tap my own wedding ring on the wheel, and wondered just what it was I thought I was doing. I watched a couple of uniformed deputies walk into the Hall of Justice. One was big like my brother, Frank. I thought again how much I'd like to see him. Just him and me sitting at a restaurant table in the north end of Boston for lunch somewhere like we used to. He'd be dressed in one of his polo shirts, turquoise or mango orange, and whether I was talking to him about money I owed or somebody I was seeing, he always gave me the same advice, which pissed me off, but sometimes made me feel better, too. It's easy, Kay. On one side of the page you got your costs, and on the other side your benefits. All you do is mark which one is which. Then you weigh one side against the other, and you get your decision just like that. That's all you ever have to do. I live by this. Sometimes it was comforting to be around someone who looked at life like this. And I would have told my brother months ago about Nick if I'd known he wouldn't tell his wife, who I knew would tell my mother. But what if you don't know the difference between a benefit and a cost? I would always ask him. What if you've never been very good at telling a plus from a minus? It was lunchtime, and small groups of men and women were leaving the building for food. I kept smoking and watched three women in business skirts and blouses sit at a concrete bench not far from my car. They were eating from small plastic yogurt containers. One of them laughed, finished her yogurt, and bit into a cookie. I knew I didn't want the office life like they were living. I knew that. But from where I sat, watching them eat and chat in the sunshine, I felt like I'd been apart from groups of normal people and their nice conversations my whole life. On another day, I might have let myself feel homeless and husbandless and with no friends, but now I felt almost better than them, tougher, like I knew more about life from having really lived it out here on the rim. I inhaled the last of my cigarette to the filter and stubbed it out in the ashtray. I was getting ready to leave, forcing myself to think about finding a safe place to park my car for tonight's sleep, when someone tapped on the window glass at my head and I jerked back. Lester Burden was standing there in the sunshine in his uniform, holding a sheaf of papers. I lowered the window all the way, and the heat from outside hit my face. My mouth was dry, and I wished I had something for the cigarette breath. "This is a surprise," Lester said, glancing at the empty passenger seat like he was trying to see who brought me here. "A good surprise or a bad one?" He smiled, his crooked mustache straightening a little. "Good, it's good. My lawyer thinks she can get me back into my house. I thought you'd like to know. I'm glad to hear this. You had lunch yet?" "I'm due in court." He pointed his thumb over his shoulder at the domed courthouse building behind him. "I'm usually out on patrol right now. Surprised you found me." "Hey, you found me." I smiled and started the car, but I felt like a woman caught peeing behind a shrub, her butt sticking out. "Well, gotta go." "Wait, I'll be up near you this afternoon." He rolled up the papers in his hands, wringing them a little. "Coffee?" "Depends on what time." I hope I didn't sound as see-through as I felt. 4 o'clock? I'll swing by your motel." There was a line of sweat right above his eyebrows. I thought of last Sunday night, seeing his car pull away from the El Rancho when I got back from the store. "I'm not there anymore. I'm staying at the Bonneville." "I don't know it." "You're looking at it, Lester." I put the car in gear and rolled the window up halfway. "I'll meet you at the Carl's Jr. in San Bruno. Have fun in court." And I pulled into the street without hardly looking. But no one honked at me, and there was plenty of road ahead and behind, and I felt my luck might really be changing after all. I made sure I wasn't at the restaurant first, but when I drove into the parking lot in San Bruno at 4:05, the sun was in my eyes and I didn't see his Toyota station wagon or even a cruiser. I waited in my car till 4:15, then hop-walked into the restaurant, keeping the weight off my wrapped foot, and I scanned the people at the counter, in the booths, and sitting at the tables. But he wasn't there, and I didn't want to be standing near the door when he came in, so I made it back to my car and sat behind the wheel another 20 minutes, eyeing everything that drove into the lot. But no Lester. At 4:45 I drove away, though I had no idea where I was going or what I would do once I got there. I felt more than disappointed. I drove around San Bruno, past short stucco houses and small dried-up yards, vaguely hoping I'd see Lester's car and follow him back to our late coffee date. My throat felt thick, my eyes burning a little. I hadn't felt this lonely in weeks, and I knew it was because I'd gotten my hopes up, and I guess I just hadn't pictured kind Deputy Sheriff Lester Burden standing me up. At a traffic light, a bald man in an open Jeep winked at me and my eyes filled, and I pulled away without waiting for the light to change. I was so sick of being in my car, sick of even the idea of driving around to find a place to stow it and me for the night. But at least it was familiar, though the rest of me was in a storage shed across from the El Rancho Motel. After almost an hour of wasting gas, I drove back there, parked the car beside my shed, and sat looking out the windshield at cars going by, thinking how I should really break down and rent another room at the El Rancho across the street, one with a TV that worked, just lie on the bed in front of it and watch hour after hour of whatever trash came on. When I got hungry, I'd pick up the phone and have something delivered. I'd write checks I couldn't afford to write. I wouldn't go to work. I wouldn't leave that bed in that room until Connie Walsh called me to move back into my house. That's how I felt. But back into what, really? Cleaning people's houses and offices? Chain-watching movies on the VCR? Waiting for my husband to come back? Lying to my family? I lit a cigarette and blew the smoke out the window. In the program, they tell you, at these times in life, to halt. If you're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, any of these, you should slow down and watch your step. I happened to be all four. I knew it. And the last thing I felt like doing was facing the BEAST in the air and recognizing the enemy voice in my head so I could start accusing it of fucking malice. My foot throbbed. I leaned back against the door and propped it on the passenger seat. The Arabic woman had done a good job wrapping it up. I had to admit that. But how come I didn't explain the situation to her when I was back in the house? This is what I was wondering just as a San Mateo County Sheriff's Department car pulled off the street into the lot, its long radio antenna swaying, Lester Burden lifting his hand off the steering wheel to wave hello. He left his engine running and walked over to my window, and I swung my leg off the seat and sat up. There were sweat stains under his arms, and his gold star hung away from his shirt. "I'm sorry about the coffee, Kathy. I got a call on a domestic. Did you wait long?" "Just an hour or two." "I am sorry. I'm kidding. Forget it. I drove around." I hoped I didn't sound as happy as I felt seeing him now. "Still want coffee?" "Yes." He had both hands on the door, looking right at me with that dark look again. A wanting, I thought. Definitely a wanting. I glanced down at my hands on the steering wheel. "You mind riding in a patrol car?" "Only if you're not busting me." He smiled, and I parked the Bonneville behind the truck stop between two 18-wheelers. I hop-walked to Lester's cruiser, and when I slid in and pulled the door shut, he asked me about my foot, his face hard and soft at the same time. I told him about waking up this morning on Bisgrove Street, about the carpenters and the piece of roof on my yard. Lester started to shake his head and get that long-eyed look from me I didn't want. So I told him again how Connie Walsh promised to have me back home by the weekend, and now I had someone I could celebrate with. I felt a little too naked putting it that way, and Lester didn't say anything back, just put his cruiser into gear and pulled out of the truck lot heading west. I looked at the black radio set into the console, the green and orange scanner lights. There was a shotgun clipped under the dashboard, and I glanced over at Lester behind the wheel. He was shaking his head. "Does your lawyer know you're sleeping in your car?" "She thinks I'm with friends. That's what she wants to think, anyway." "What do you mean?" "I mean there's a limit to how much she wants to help, that's all. She has her limits." He drove onto the Cabrillo Highway and went quiet a minute. "There's no one you can stay with, Kathy?" I shrugged, my face heating up. "You don't meet a lot of people cleaning houses, I guess." I felt his eyes on me. I squinted out at the bright ocean. My foot ached, and I wanted my sunglasses. We passed a few cars, and I watched the drivers hold their heads still, glancing down at their speedometers and keeping their eyes on the road, only looking up once we'd pulled away. "You ever get used to that?" I said. "What?" I nodded out the window at the slowing traffic. "People you don't know being scared of you?" "You really think they're scared?" "Scared enough to mind their P's and Q's." Lester turned off Cabrillo into the lot of a hot dog and ice cream shack on the beach. There were picnic tables on both sides of it and in back, and 5 or 6 teenage boys and girls sat at one near the order window. Their arms, legs, and faces were tanned or sunburned. When they saw Lester get out of the car, they looked away like he was the 14th cop they'd seen in the past 10 minutes, and I liked being on the other end of that look. I could smell cooked hot dogs, the cigarette smoke of the teenagers, somebody's tanning lotion. The girl working behind the window told Lester they didn't have coffee, so he said 2 Cokes would be fine, but then he looked over at me to check, and I smiled at him. In the shadow behind the shack, Les carried our drinks while I hopped through the cigarette butts in the sand. We sat at a weathered picnic table, and way ahead of us, the Pacific Ocean seemed to be pulling out into low tide, its waves coming in long and small before they finally broke. Out on the water was a blue-gray cloud bank, the kind that usually came in as a fog, and the sky around it was a haze. Lester sat next to me on the bench facing the beach, and for a while we just looked out at the water. I drank for my Coke and turned to him enough to take in his profile, his deep-set brown eyes and small nose and badly trimmed mustache. Again, there was this gentleness to him. This quiet. "How did you ever end up in that uniform, Lester?" "Les," he glanced at me and smiled. "Les." I was smiling too, but like a flirt, I thought. Like I wasn't really interested in the answer to my question. "I was planning on being a teacher, actually." "That's what you look like. I mean, that's what you seem like to me." I wanted to light a cigarette, but didn't want the taste in my mouth. Not right now. "So then how come you're a boy in blue?" He shook his head and looked down at the old tabletop, at a plank where someone had carved 2 breasts with X-shaped nipples. My wife was pregnant. The academy was cheaper than graduate school. The guaranteed job afterwards, that kind of thing. "You like it?"
"Mostly."
"Mostly?" He smiled at me, but his eyes had gone soft, and he suddenly seemed too tender, so I looked straight ahead again, at the cloud bank that had moved closer in just the past few minutes. The haze around it, too. The beach sand wasn't as bright as before, and I caught the smell of seaweed. "Fog's coming in," I said. I could feel him still looking at me. I drank from my Coke until the ice slid to my teeth. "Kathy?"
"Yeah?"
"I'd like to ask you something personal, if I could."
"All right, get it over with."
I was kidding him again, but I couldn't look at him, so kept my eyes on the green water, on the haze it seemed to make.
"Why is your husband not with you any longer?"
I watched a low wave ride all the way into the beach, and just before it broke, I felt I was rooting for it, hoping it wouldn't. I wanted kids and he didn't. I don't know. I think if he really wanted me, he would have wanted them too, you know? Lester put his hand over mine on the table. It was warm and heavy. He's a fool. I looked down at his hand. "Have you been watching me, Officer Burden?"
"Yes."
"Good."
"It is?"
"That you didn't lie." He took a breath. "I haven't stopped thinking of you since the eviction, Kathy." I looked at him now. His voice was quiet, but there was something like boldness in his eyes. My right foot ached, but our knees were touching. He lowered his eyes, but then, as if he'd made himself do it, he looked back at me, his brown eyes not bold anymore. He reminded me of me. He squeezed my hand, and I suddenly felt so close to him that kissing him didn't even feel like a forward movement. His mustache was prickly and soft against my upper lip, and I let my mouth open, and I tasted his sweet Coke. I held his back, and he held mine, and the kiss went on for a long time, it seemed, until we finally took a breath and pulled apart, and the fog was floating in close to the beach, and it was getting hard to see the water. I looked at him,
at his small straight nose, his lower lip beneath his mustache, his shaved chin. When I got to his eyes that were taking me in so completely, my mouth felt funny, so I focused on his gold star badge, his name etched on the tag beneath it, and I wanted to run my fingertips over the letters. The temperature had dropped, and I had goose pimples on my arms and legs. Let's find you a place to stay. Les stood up and grabbed our empty cups, and as he helped me over the sand to his car, I didn't say anything. We rode quietly through Corona into San Bruno, where he turned north just before the El Camino Real highway. Under the gray sky, we passed one-story houses with small grass lawns. Behind them was the highway, and I could see the cars and long trucks going south for towns like Hillsboro, I guessed, San Carlos, Menlo Park, Los Altos, and Sunnyvale, towns I'd driven through alone for months now, telling myself I wasn't looking for Nikki's gray Honda. Les was quiet behind the wheel, and even though we were in his police cruiser, it was so familiar to be sitting on the passenger side of a car with a man driving again that I felt sort of up and down all at once. Then we were away from houses and in a neighborhood of gas stations, fast food restaurants, and a shopping center right next to the highway. "So where are we going, Les?" He looked at me, then rested his hand on my knee and turned left, driving past the shopping center to a stretch of motel and travel inns on a grassy hill along the El Camino Real Highway. "You want a pool?" Without waiting for me to answer, he turned into the small parking lot of the Eureka Motor Lodge, a two-story white brick building with a fake-looking terracotta roof. Outside the office door were two Coke machines and an ice machine. A carved wooden sign hung over its window. "Eureka, I have found it." "This neighborhood's better than the other one, Kathy. I can't let you sleep in your car." "I'll have to pay you back." "Shh," he put his finger close to my lips. I pretended to bite it, and he smiled, then went into the office, all uniform, gun, and wedding ring. For a second, I asked myself just what I was doing anyway, but then I concentrated on how good a bath would feel, a firm bed with clean sheets. The room was in the back, away from the highway, facing the pool. Les helped me in, then excused himself to go to the bathroom. I sat at the foot of a queen-size bed covered with a periwinkle spread. The floor was carpeted and clean. Against the curtain window were two cushioned chairs on each side of a small glass-topped table. In front of me was a color TV on a stand next to a walnut dresser and mirror. I couldn't see my reflection from where I sat, so I started to stand on my good foot when the toilet flushed, the water ran, and Les walked back into the room, drying his hands on a towel he dropped on the dresser. "Looks like you've done this before," I said. "Why do you say that?" He stood where he was, a hurt look on his face, his hands resting on his gun belt. "Sorry, it was just a joke." He opened his mouth like he was going to say more. Then he squatted at a mini fridge on the other side of the dresser and pulled out two cans of Michelob, handing me one. It was cold in my hands, and I looked down at it in my lap, like I was seeing an old Polaroid of somebody I used to know, and for a second didn't know why I didn't anymore. Les opened his and drank from it right there, standing over me. But I couldn't even look up at him. I let the can drop to the floor, and I flopped back on the bed and covered my face. What was I doing? My foot hurt, hanging off the bed like that, and I actually wondered if my thighs looked fat from where he stood. I heard him rest his beer can on the dresser, then squat to pick up the other, the leather of his gun belt creaking. The mattress sank with his weight, and I lowered my hands, and he was looking into my face, leaning on one arm so his shoulder moved up to his ear. He looked almost feminine that way, and for some reason it made me want to kiss him again. He was moving his middle finger over my wrist and forearm, and his eyes didn't have that boldness in them anymore, but they didn't look sad either. "You have no idea who I am, Lester. I think you're the most beautiful woman I've ever seen." I put my hand on his warm, hairy arm, and he leaned down and kissed me. His tongue was cool from the beer, and I could taste it, and that did something to me. I scooted away from him and sat back against the headboard. What, Kathy? I wanted a cigarette, but didn't know where I'd left them. I crossed my arms in front of me. Les sat at the foot of the bed looking at me like I was about to say something deep. I haven't had a drink in almost 3 years, Lester. I'm sorry, I didn't know. I know you didn't, but you don't know much about me, do you? His lips were parted beneath his mustache, and he looked away, stood, then walked over and took his can of beer into the bathroom, and I could hear him pouring it down the sink. I wanted to tell him he didn't have to do that, but I didn't trust my voice not to sound bitchy. The air conditioner in the wall came on, though the room was already too cool, but my foot felt squeezed and hot, and I leaned forward and undid the safety pin the Arab woman had put in the ace bandage. It felt good to unwrap it, and as I pulled it off, Les came out of the bathroom, and I was afraid my foot would smell a little. It did. Lester squatted and looked at the sole. You should soak it. There was a new look to his face now, distracted, like he was late for being somewhere else but wasn't quite sure where that place was, or if it even existed. You didn't have to dump that beer, Les. It's not like that. His eyes caught mine. What's it like then, Kathy? I'd like to know. You would? Yes, I would. I believed him, and I didn't like him standing over my smelly foot like that. I put my hand on the spread. Come here. He hesitated a half second, as if he didn't know what I had in mind, and truthfully, I don't think I had anything in mind. I just wanted him to get away from my foot. But when he sat on the bed beside me, then leaned over and kissed my forehead, my cheek, my lips, his hand pressed to my rib cage, the other stroking my hair back, it was like I was an empty well and didn't know it until just now, when he uncovered me and it started to rain, and I pulled him on me and opened my mouth, and I held the sides of his head and kissed him so hard our teeth knocked together. I kissed his cheeks, his eyes, his nose. I licked his mustache and kissed him open-mouthed again. I began to unbutton his shirt, and he pulled my T-shirt over my head. Then everything slowed down as he touched my breasts. A change came over him and me too. He looked into my eyes, checking on something one last time. Then he sat up and very slowly untied his shoes. He put them aside, unsnapped his pistol from its holster, and laid it on the bedside table. When he pulled his shirt tails from his pants, I swung my legs to the other side of the bed, unsnapped my shorts, and pulled them and my underpants off. My fingers were shaking, and I was thirsty, but now the throbbing heat of my punctured foot had moved up between my legs, and I lay back on the bed just as Les stepped out of his boxer shorts, his rear small and dark. He turned to face me, and I made myself look up at his crooked mustache, at his messed-up hair, his narrow shoulders. I was 16 all over again. Ma gone shopping, Dad at work, plenty of time before we get caught. I gripped his shoulders, drew my heels up along the backs of his legs, and pulled him forward.
Earlier there was fog, but now the sky is the color of peaches, and the sun is low over the ocean I cannot yet see from our home. The Najaris have for 2 hours been gone. Before leaving, they cleaned up the area well, covering the new lumber with a large green canvas they weighted with old wood from the roof. I sit upon the front step and view my son using the rake to gather the cut grass in the yard. He wears what is called a tank shirt and short pants which are quite loose, and I see the long muscles beginning to show in his arms and legs, his shoulders as well. Set over his head are the yellow earphones of his Walkman radio Nadi purchased for him in Japantown. I am certain he is listening to California rock and roll music that to me sounds as pleasant as 5 F-16s flying over one's head. In this final light of day, his skin is a lovely golden brown, and for a moment I find myself thinking of our dead Shah Pahlavi. It is not often I take alcohol, but last evening Nadia and I drank only one glass of champagne each, and the bottle cost over $35. Now it is somewhat flat, but I do not care. Fresh nistam, and I drink from one of the crystal flutes we acquired on the Rue de Turenne in Paris. I tell to myself I am not allowing waste by drinking this champagne. But I know I am simply attempting to prolong the feeling of celebration I had when I purchased it. For inside my head I continue to hear what the Najjar told me of the young lady, saying she was the owner of this bungalow, and I try to replace his words with those of his colleague, who insisted she seemed crazy, divunée, and she is likely claiming ownership all over the town. After cutting the grasses, I thought of phoning the gentleman at the county tax office who supervised the auction, perhaps make an inquiry of this woman, but I was not able to pick up the telephone. If there is no snake at your feet, do not lift rocks at the side of the road. Through the screen door at my back, I smell the meat broth and stewing tomatoes of Abgusht, the steaming rice and tadik. As she works in the kitchen, Nadire is singing softly to herself one of Gugush's songs of love. Of course I have said nothing to her of what the Najjars informed me. Instead, I asked her to prepare a menu and shopping list for the dinner party we will host for our daughter, new son-in-law, and his family. My wife's face became so lighted with happiness at this, at the modest fashion in which our lives appeared to be returning to the old ways, that she pinched my cheek and said, "Oh, Jujeman, my little chicken," something she has not said to me in many years. My son bags the cut grass and moves his head up and down to the music only he hears. My wife hums contentedly in the kitchen, and I feel foolish for worrying more than God ever wants us to. I call out to Ismail that he dances like a rooster, but he does not hear me, and I begin to think of Saraya, of how tightly I will hold her upon her return. And I am thinking so deeply of this moment, of the love I hold for that dear girl, that when the small white automobile drives up the hill and stops in front of the woodland across the street, I stand, thinking it is them returning early, surprising us at our new home. But written on the driver's door is Bay Area Couriers, and soon I am holding in my hand a sealed envelope from a Society of Legal Aid, Lambert and Walsh, attorneys at law. My name is misspelled upon the front. I tear open the paper, but I must go indoors for my glasses, and I close the office door and sit at my desk. Dear sir, I am writing to inform you this firm has determined the property at 34 Bisgrove Street, Corona, California, to have been auctioned to you under improper and erroneous circumstances by the tax officers of San Mateo County. We have today notified the county regarding this matter, and we request the sale of the aforementioned property be promptly rescinded so the rightful owner may be restored proprietorship of her home. Please be advised you will be expected to vacate the premises as soon as possible. We regret any inconvenience this may cause you. Sincerely yours, C.S. Walsh, Attorney at Law. Three times I read the letter, and I begin a fourth time to read it when my hands tear the paper to pieces and I throw them at the trash basket where they scatter and fall to the floor. My heart beats as if I have just climbed a mountain. I pick up a pen and break it, the blue ink spraying once into the air. Oh, this country, this terrible place! What manner of society is it when one cannot expect a business transaction to be completed once the papers have been signed and the money deposited? What do they think? No, it is clear they do not think. They are idiots, and they are weak, and they are stupid. And what of the widow's walk? What of that? Will they return my $1,100? Will they return to me my $45,000? But I must not even think of such an event, for I will not accept the return of anything. I will proceed as planned. I will sell this bungalow for the profit to which I am entitled, and may God damn them all to hell. A sale is a sale. They cannot stop it now. It is too late. How can this be a legal practice? I must phone them immediately. I lower myself to my knees and search through bits of paper for the letterhead of this lawyer. Nadi steps into the room, polishing a silver serving bowl she holds with two hands. Chikarmikuni Masood. Hichi, nothing, I am doing nothing. But she must see something in my face, for her eyes darken and she stops passing the rag over the bowl. I begin to gather the letter pieces from the floor. In Farsi, she asks, "What is wrong, Masood? What is this mess?"
I missed the container, that is all.
Is it time for eating? I feel a bit weak.
This answer seems for her enough, and she tells to me she said not to stay in the sun so long.
And the champagne, Masood. Come, you must eat, come.
I stand and she takes my hand and leads me down the hallway, but I pull free and say I must wash my hands. Then I am coming.
You must hurry, Ismail is hungry.
In the office, I fold the lawyer's envelope into my pants pocket. It is too late to call these leeches, these maldar gendes, these mother whores, but tomorrow I will drive there myself. I do not want them telephoning here. Nadire must know nothing of this. Nothing. In the bathroom, I wash my hands and arms with hot water and some of Nadi's lavender soap. The water is very hot, and I let it grow hotter still, and I fill my hands with it. I want to open them, but I lower my head and splash my face, scalding my nose and cheeks, the lids of my closed eyes. I shut the water and leave the bathroom, sitting upon the floor at the dinner sofre with my wife and son. In Farsi, Nadi to me says,
"Eh, Masood, your face is wet. Why did you not dry yourself?"
She rises and brings to me a towel.
"What is wrong with you, Behrani? Sometimes you act like a child."
We made love till we were both so hungry we had to stop and Les left to go buy us something to eat. While he was gone, I stayed under the sheet and blanket, laying on my stomach and breasts, one knee drawn up beside me, damp and sore between my legs. When Les opened the door to leave, I could see that the fog had lifted outside and the sun was almost down, but now the dusky light coming through the curtained window made the room dim. For a while, I stared at the pistol he'd left on the bedside table. It had a black checkered grip and square-looking barrel. It was so strange he was in that job. He made love so tenderly, moving as if each push and pull depended on if I liked it or not. And it made me think of Nick, the difference in their two bodies. Nick's back was smooth and cool, a little fat, while Lester's was hard, his skin heated. Nick would bury his face in my neck and sometimes suck on my skin, while Lester kept kissing me on the mouth and face and shoulders like he'd been on a long trip and was finally home. He came twice, both times inside me, but I didn't say anything, just held him. For a black second I thought of the virus, of being unprotected from it, but then reminded myself I was with a married man, which made me feel better in one way but worse in another. Nick wasn't coming back. Waiting for Lester in the Eureka Motor Lodge, I think I knew this for the first time, that my husband was really gone, that one day I'd hear from his lawyer, get a phone call or a letter or both, but not from Nicky himself. And for some reason, because I just slept with a man, I knew that day was closer in coming than before, than even this morning when I woke up in our car across from our house like some refugee. I took a long shower like there was nothing more to feel about this afternoon than the hot water on my face and breasts, my upper back and rear, the steam clearing my nose and lungs, the slip of the bar soap in my hands, the slightly bruised feeling between my legs, and the ache in my shin and foot. I felt as connected to the ground as an old newspaper blowing down the street. I started to feel a little scared, and as I turned off the shower, I could hear Lester out in the room taking something from paper bags. The mirror was too fogged to see my face, but I didn't want to anyway. I wrapped myself in two towels, then limped out to the room and sat at the glass-topped table near the window across from Les, who just finished laying out paper plates and plastic forks and takeout boxes of Szechuan food that smelled like soy and cooked meat. He was smiling at me, taking me in. He leaned down and took my face in his hands, kissing my cheeks and lips. I held his wrists and kissed him back, surprised at how grateful I felt when he did that. We ate beef teriyaki on pointed sticks, fried rice, spring rolls, and hot mushy pork we wrapped in thin pancakes. Sometimes I would look over at him, and he'd smile and I'd smile back. I was still eating when he stood up, took something from the bag, then squatted in front of me and started rubbing ointment on the bottom of my foot. It tickled more than it hurt, and I laughed. Okay, that's enough. It's antibiotic. I bought you some gauze, too. My legs were parted, and he was rubbing my foot with both hands, smiling up into my face, his mustache a straight line, his deep brown eyes as warm as any I'd ever seen. I was suddenly wet, and I stood, twisted from his hands and lay back on the bed, opening my towel for him, and almost immediately he was inside me again, his pants around his ankles, his star and name tag pushing against my skin. After, he took a shower. I knew he was washing the smell of us off him, and I wondered how he would explain getting home so late to his wife, the wet hair. The word wife sort of sunk into my stomach like hot metal, but then I thought of how I was a wife too, and that my husband was probably with somebody else right this second. But this was such a lame excuse for what I was doing, and I could hear the water shut off in the bathroom, the curtain jerking open. My Wednesday house was the CPA's on the Como River. There was a small deck overlooking the trees down to the water, and I stood out there now, leaning on the railing to give my right foot a break. I'd been hopping around on the toes of it all morning while I vacuumed, dusted, and straightened up, and every few minutes my calf muscles started to bunch up in a cramp, and I had to stop and knead it until it relaxed again. The deck was cool and shaded, but the sunlight was all over the river, bringing out the green in it, a layer of pollen floating along the surface. The air smelled like sewage and bark, and I could hear the crows up in the trees. It felt good to be working, even though I probably should have listened to Les and rested another day. Last night he drove me back to my car in San Bruno. We kissed goodbye in the light of the storage shed lot. Then I came back here, lugged in my suitcase, and bagged the leftover Szechuan food and stuffed it into the mini fridge bar on the floor. Inside were small green bottles of Inglenook white wine, nips of Smirnoff vodka, and Bailey's Irish Cream, two Heinekens and the can of Michelob. I flicked on the TV, lay on the bed, and watched most of a movie about a man who kills his wife and three kids and gets away with it for almost 20 years before they catch him living a new life with a new family only a state and a half away. When the phone rang, I didn't know I was almost asleep. It was Lester saying he was at a phone booth down the street from his house. He already missed me. Then he paused, I think to give me a chance to say I missed him too, but I couldn't say that. I was used to being alone, and right then I needed something I was used to. He asked if he could take me to breakfast. I told him yeah, though when I hung up it was as if I wasn't anchored all the way to the ground, like when you've had too much to drink, but you don't know it until you lie down. And it's that instant right before the room begins to turn when you feel the chains break away. I was glad he'd called, but I also felt like a kept woman, and I guess I told him that this morning over coffee at Carl's Jr. It was only 6:30, but almost all the counter stools were taken up with men in trekker caps, some in suits and ties, drinking their coffees and reading newspapers between bites of eggs, toast, and home fries. Half the tables were full, too. Lester was in his uniform, already 30 minutes into his 6-to-6 shift, he told me. His shirt had neat creases in the sleeves, and I pictured his wife ironing it for him the night before. It was hard to look right into his face. I was glad when the waitress came to take our order and left us with 2 cups of coffee. This is on me, Lester. I said I'd take you to breakfast. You did. You drove me here. Now I'm buying. Keep your money, Kathy. You'll need it. He sipped his coffee, his eyes still on me. You're paying for my room. What do I fucking need money for? I was a little surprised at how mad I was. Lester put down his cup. He started to reach over for my hand, but then stopped himself. He leaned forward and said, quiet and low, I'm not sure what's happening here either, Kathy, but I do know I'm not trying to make you some toy of mine. I just had to see you before it was another day. And what? That's all. No, what? I touched his hand. I didn't feel mad anymore. Before it was another day, and what? You'd forget. He looked into my face and scrunched his lips up sideways, his cheeks and throat darkening. He had to be the sweetest-looking man I'd ever seen.
Ha! You're lucky I even remembered how.
I leaned forward. You'll have to wear something next time, though, cowboy.
I'm embarrassed.
Yeah, well, I lightly slapped his hand. Don't do it again. Our waitress showed up with the food right then, and we both started to laugh. When he dropped me off at the motor lodge, we kissed a long time in the front seat of his cruiser. He asked if he could stop by after his shift, and I said yeah, he could. But as he left, I felt that off-the-ground sensation again, things turning too fast, and I knew I had to get back into my normal routine, hurt foot or not. I watched a leafy branch float down the river in the sunshine, then I limped back inside to finish up, but first I had to check on Connie Walsh's progress because I knew nothing was going to make me feel more rooted than getting back into my house. I sat on the arm of the black Naugahyde couch so many middle-aged men seemed to buy, and I punched in the number that, by now, I knew as well as my own mother's.
The mother whores are located above a coffee house, not far from the Highway Department Depot and the Concourse Hotel. I walk from the cool darkness of the underground garage that smells of car exhaust and dried oil upon concrete, carrying my leather valise under my arm. And for this meeting I have dressed in my finest suit, a summer-weight cashmere and mohair, black double-breasted, I purchased from a Pakistani in North Tehran. The shirt is white, the tie is blue and brown, the color of steel. As I left the bungalow, Nadi asked me why I was dressed so, and I told to her the truth. I am taking care of important business today, Nadi, investment business. She asked no more questions. This morning, Nadire wore a cotton pantsuit the color of red shahrab. She had brushed her hair until it was full and well-shaped upon her head, and she had applied cosmetics to her eyes, cheeks, and lips. She smiled and handed to me the shopping list for this Saturday's party for our daughter, and Nadi looked so ziba then, so beautiful in her new expectations, that I drove from the bungalow and down the hill with a furnace in my stomach for what I must accomplish. And, of course, I feel it even more so as I walk from the Concourse Hotel, for I am thinking of long days under the sun with Tran, Torres, and the Panamanian pig Mendez. I am recalling the highway dust upon my clothes that stick to my skin with sweat, the burn on my bare head, the kuni behind the desk in the hotel's lobby who would see all these things and give me not enough respect for even the common kagar I had become. But as I walk beneath a sky that is full of sun, I advise myself to practice discipline and forget these things, for they leave me also with a feeling of having been beaten before I have even fought. I am a Janob Sarhang, a retired colonel of the Imperial Air Force. I have honored all the legalities in the buying of this bungalow, and I am certain there is nothing they can do to change this fact. The waiting area at the top of the stairs is small and shabby, and this gives to me more hope. I tell the smiling kuni at the desk my business, and he offers me to sit, but I stand and wait. On the walls are advertisements for parades of women who love women and kunis who love kunis. This sort of freedom I will never understand. What manner of society is it when one can do whatever one feels like doing? I have been told other cities in America are not as free as this one. A young Pudar doctor in the high-rise apartments of Berkeley told me this, that the heart of this country, a place called the Middle West, is more proper than the cities of both coasts. Ohio, he said. Iowa. Perhaps, after selling the bungalow, I will move my wife and son there. But Nadire would not wish to live so far from Soraya, not now with the possibility of grandchildren. And I would miss the sea, for even though it is the Pacific and not the Caspian, its vast presence is a reminder to me. Mr. Barmini? The lawyer's secretary is dressed nicely in a gray skirt and blouse, but she wears no shoes upon her feet. Behrani. My name is Colonel Masood Amir Behrani. I wish to speak with Mr. Walsh, please. She smiles. I'm Connie Walsh. This is my office, Colonel. Please come with me. The woman lawyer gives me no time to apologize for my mistake, and I follow her into a room with a large table and many chairs and tall windows open to the bright air. She offers me coffee or tea. I would like tea, but I tell to her no thank you, and when I sit, I do not allow myself to become too comfortable. I take a short breath to begin my talk, but it is as if she knows what I have come to say and raises her hand. I'm sure our letter came as a shock to you, Colonel. The situation is this. San Mateo County has made a number of mistakes. First, they levied a tax on my client, the previous owner of the property she did not owe. Second, they evicted her for non-payment. And third, they auctioned the property. Unfortunately, sir, this is where you come in. And I'm afraid we have no choice but to demand the county reverse this whole process by rescinding the sale so my client can reclaim her home. I feel a heaviness in my fingers, a heat in my chest and face. But I now own the home. Is the sale final? Of course. I paid for it cash. I have a bill of sale. I open my valise and withdraw all the paperwork from the sale of the home. The woman lawyer examines them a moment. She sits back in her chair and looks into my eyes as directly as would a man of influence and status. Are you willing to sell the county back the house? I'd see to it they made it as comfortable a transaction as possible. Please to me listen very carefully, Miss Walsh. The only comfortable transaction possible is if the county tax office pays to me $170,000 for the property. If they pay me this, I will move, but only in the autumn season. My wife is sick, and she needs a summer's rest. I also will require time to find a new home. Mr. Barani, you paid a quarter of that. I stand and step away from the chair. The market will already pay me this. I believe this is something you should discuss with the gentleman at the county tax office. Good morning, Miss Walsh. I offer my hand to this woman lawyer. She takes it very briefly, and she stands as well. The rightful owner of that house is living in a motel, Mr. Barani. All her belongings are locked in storage. Why should she have to wait any longer than necessary to get back into the home that was wrongfully taken from her? Again, I feel the blood in my chest, my face, behind my eyes. Who are these people? To whom do they think they are speaking? Of course, you do not understand what I have said. I am the rightful owner of this property. I am being wronged. You have heard my offer. You are fortunate I have decided to sell the property at all. I leave quickly and without another word. The downstairs cafe is full of people seated at small tables drinking coffee, eating pastries. There is music playing, one of the European composers, and men and women who have dressed in only t-shirts and blue jeans look up at me as I pass them by. They view my face, my suit, the valise under my arm, and as I return their eyes back to them, they look away as if I have come to collect something they cannot pay.
I spent the last of the afternoon on a lawn chair at the deep end of the motel's pool. No one else was around, and I closed my eyes to the sun, smoked, sipped a Diet Coke, and kept tapping my good foot on the warm concrete. I couldn't relax. I still didn't like the way Connie had sounded on the phone earlier. She'd said she'd seen the new owner this morning, and the good news was he was willing to sell the house back to the county, but the county still had to admit their mistake, want to rescind the sale, then actually buy it back. She sounded tired and put out, like she had nine other things on her mind. She told me to call back at the end of the day. Then she made herself sound cheerful and told me to stay optimistic. We're just warming up. I didn't like how she put that. If I was going to move back into my house this weekend, shouldn't we be heated up pretty hot already? Still, I was glad to hear the Arab family was willing to sell and move, and I was trying to concentrate on that piece of the news. A shadow moved over me, and I looked up into Lester's smiling face. I hadn't heard his car pull up. The top two buttons of his uniform shirt were undone, and he stood with his fingers resting on his hips. "Hey," I said. "Hey, yourself." He squatted, his leather holster creaking slightly. He took my hand and kissed it. "Let me take you on a proper date tonight, Kathy." His eyes looked hopeful, and I couldn't help myself.